Good morning, and thank you for attending session 211, titled Mormon Mental Health, Leaving Plato's Cave, Understanding and Transcending Our Objectification of Others. Before we begin, we ask that cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep in mind that when engaging in the Q&A portion of the session following the remarks of the presenter, those who cannot abide by those guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave should they become disruptive. This session is being recorded, and you'll be able to purchase it at the presentation after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Take advantage of our symposium special by subscribing to Sunstone Magazine, 7 issues for the price of 6 at the registration desk as well. Consider also purchasing Skull Candy official headphones customized just for Sunstoners. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. And don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books. Consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so that we can allow for the next session to start on time. And as a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after this session, you clear the room and speak outside so other presentations can begin preparation for the next session. Rather than offering, the abstract here is, rather than offering a narrow definition of objectification, this presentation explores as its spectrum of misapprehension, running from its mildest form, which is casual indifference, to its most extreme manifestation, which is dehumanization, gleaning insights from classic philosophy, the world's 5 most prominent religious traditions, and current social science research. The presentation examines the best antidotes humankind has devised thus far to move us from a casual concern for our fellow human beings towards interconnectedness and ultimately unity consciousness. And our speaker today is John M. Rector, PhD, and he is a psychologist with over 20 years of experience teaching and clinical experience. And in 2014, Dr. Rector published his first book with the Oxford University Press entitled The Objectification Spectrum, Understanding and Transcending Our Diminishment and Dehumanization of Others. So with no further ado, we will jump into our presentation and we will have a few minutes for questions at the end. Thank you.
Hi. I want to thank everyone for being here. There are a lot of really interesting topics on offer this morning, and so I thought, you know, has anybody seen Little Miss Sunshine? Little Miss Sunshine in here? Just a couple of you. If you remember the very beginning, Greg Kinnear's character, he's giving a presentation on his 9 steps, and he's got an audience of like 6. So I kind of feel like that, but at least what you're going to hear today is coming from a book that I was really flattered to have Oxford University Press pick it up back in July of 2014. So it's not just, 9 steps towards success, but hopefully something a little bit more substantive for you here today. I really appreciate your attendance nonetheless. Does anyone know what this is a picture of? Does anybody recognize this? Yes. Would you be willing to... What is this? Who is this?
It's a Syrian refugee on the Turkish shore.
Exactly. Does anyone know why this picture really mattered? Yes.
Because the West wasn't really responding to the Syrian refugee crisis until this quarter of the news. They actually did a class project.
Did you? Fascinating. Yes, excellent response, too. Yes, this is a picture of Alan Kudi. He was 3 years old, and along with his family, he was supposed to end up in Europe. Instead, the sea journey claimed his life and highlighted the plight of desperate people caught in the worst migrant refugee crisis since World War II. He drowned after the 15-foot boat ferrying him capsized, killing 12 passengers. Alan's 5-year-old brother, Galip, his mother, Rehan, were also among the dead. And his father, Abdullah, was the only family member to survive, and he remained in Turkey. And if you can just try to imagine that for a moment, you know, what that would be like, watching your family drown before your eyes. Before Alan's tragic death and the photo of his lifeless body on a Turkish beach, this was the sort of image most of us saw of the Syrian refugees. Yet such images of mass suffering failed to move us like a picture of a single lifeless 3-year-old boy. There are reasons for this, and this is what I'd like to talk about today. I assume that most of you were attracted to my presentation because of its subject, objectification. Many people have heard of and even used this word in conversation, but when I set out to write a book about it, I found that there was considerable lack of precision about what objectification actually means. So without getting too technical here, here is how I make sense of it. Human beings are multifaceted, integrated creatures with a rich, immaterial psychic dimension and also an external, physical, bodily dimension. Both of these are fundamental to our existence and to our identity as a member of the species. However, when we objectify others, we overemphasize the external bodily dimension, thereby diminishing or denying the significance of the inner psychic dimension. We see others not as integrated wholes of psyche and soma, worthy of respect and even reverence, but more as objects, a mere shell or shadow of their true selves. Another way of understanding objectification is that it represents a misapprehension of reality. It's not that we're hallucinating or anything like that, but we tend to perceive a substantial, thick boundary between ourselves and the rest of the world out there, which disables us from seeing ourselves in others. Now, according to the wisest minds of all time, this boundary does not have to be so thick. Indeed, it doesn't even have to exist. So today, I want to talk specifically about both human nature and the nature of objectification, because I argue that you cannot have one without the other. Indeed, in my book, I make the assertion that we are all objectifiers, each and every one of us. This is why we weren't particularly moved by images of masses of miserable, displaced people. This is why it took an image of a lifeless 3-year-old to finally get some of our attention. We are all objectifiers for two main reasons. First, objectification is a complex, spectrum-like phenomenon which is easy to participate in. And second, objectifying comes quite naturally to human beings, almost as if we can't help ourselves. Okay, so the many faces of objectification. It's common to think of objectification as an either-or, all-or-nothing phenomenon like pregnancy. Either you're pregnant or you're not. Either you're objectifying or you're not. However, if we think more deeply about this, and about most human traits or behavioral tendencies, we realize that they present themselves as a spectrum, and objectification is no different. In its mild versions, objectification is typified by what I call casual indifference. And this is where we experience little or no discernible emotional discomfort at the realization of some distant other's suffering. Examples are many, of course. For instance, when we hear about an acquaintance being diagnosed with inoperable cancer, we may feel initial concern for that acquaintance, but the moment quickly passes, and we become reabsorbed into the busyness of our daily lives. Has anyone here experienced this? I have. In fact, I experienced this as I was writing this paragraph in my book, ironically enough. Of course, it can be argued that casual indifference has survival value. After all, we can't very well take care of ourselves and our families if we're deeply impacted by the suffering of everyone we know. Perhaps because it's adaptive in this way, casual indifference is the kind of objectification most people experience most of the time. Derivativization, and that's a real mouthful, but it's a good word. Derivativization represents the vast mid-range of the objectification spectrum. To derivatize others is to perceive them as being merely derivative of oneself, a reflection of one's own identity, desires, fears, and other emotions. We then use those we derivatize in a variety of ways to satisfy our own ends at their expense. And derivativization comes in many guises, from the seemingly trivial to the sadistically violent. One example of mild derivativization includes a Miller Lite beer commercial from the early 2000s. Does anyone remember this commercial? I actually debated about actually pressing play here and showing the commercial, but my wife and I both thought, nah, it's just way too offensive. But for any of you that don't remember this commercial, it starts out in the typical Miller Lite fashion, where you have two very attractive women on a summer veranda having the discussion about whether the beer is less filling or tastes great. Well, they soon get into an argument that escalates into the catfight, quote unquote, where these women start to hit each other and tear at each other's clothes, and just happened to tumble into a fountain that was nearby. So you've got all these people on the veranda who are watching this fight between these two women happen as they proceed to continue to tear off each other's clothes in the fountain with high kicks and squeals and grunts. The next thing you know, they're out of the fountain and they have fallen into another very conveniently located mud pit. So in the mud pit, they grapple at one another, grunt, groan, kick, slap. And at the end, it changes frame and it goes to two guys in a bar who are saying, wouldn't that be an awesome commercial? Yeah, who wouldn't want to watch that? As their two dates look on just aghast that they could be having such a fantasy. And then, as if that's not enough, at the very end of the commercial that they actually had to edit out, after it aired initially, the two women looked at each other. It went back to them in the mud pit. And the two women looked at each other and said, I know, let's make out. And they started to kiss, and then the commercial went off. Okay? Yeah, so the point here is that the women in the ad are portrayed in a highly unrealistic, unethical manner, perpetuating damaging stereotypes, depicting women as being turned on by violence, where they are merely derivative of men's and the beer company's desires and purposes. A much more extreme version of derivativization was engaged in by United States military police stationed at the Abu Ghraib military prison in Iraq. And does anybody remember this scandal? Yes, just about everybody in the room. Just as a quick summary, from 2002 to 2004, so shortly after 9/11, and tensions were high, American military police, men and women, by the way, engaged in physical, psychological, and sexual abuse of Iraqi detainees. These actions included torture, rape, and eventually homicide. Thousands of trophy photos taken by the individuals involved in the abuse documented much of the activity, and leaked photos broke the scandal open to the public. One report detailed forced nudity, forced sex acts, sadistic beatings, and other forced degrading behaviors between detainees, such as the formation of nude pyramids. I remember seeing those pictures, and also with the repeated threat of harm by dogs. Whatever the external factors may have been that played a role in the American MP's treatment of prisoners, and there were some bad external factors, the abuse documented at Abu Ghraib also suggests that the prisoners became mere extensions of some of the prison personnel's feelings of boredom, impotence, anger, and resentment, and they were treated accordingly. Finally, dehumanization represents objectification at the extreme end of the spectrum. Here, we deny the humanity of certain other human beings, seeing them as being not only subhuman, but inhuman also. Dehumanization occurs in situations where one group of people wants to harm another group of people, but they can't simply murder them outright because that would be too psychologically difficult and painful. Instead, the first group begins a campaign of propaganda aimed at the other group, portraying them as something less than human and other than human. And when such images are given place in one's mind, they play on the sentiments of potential perpetrators, inciting anger, fear, distrust, and I think most importantly, disgust. This process gradually shrinks the perpetrator's perceptions of what counts as human until certain people fall outside the parameter of those who are considered valid members of the species. This extreme form of objectification leads to the worst atrocities that the world has ever known, such as the Holocaust, the Rwandan genocide, the wiping out of indigenous Americans, the African slave trade, among many others. Okay, and now human nature. What is it about us that makes us so prone to seeing other people as objects? The world's great sages throughout history have long understood that human beings have this tendency. Plato, perhaps the most famous philosopher, greatest philosopher to ever have lived, made this a central tenet of his teaching. In his Allegory of the Cave, and by the way, how many of you in here have ever heard of the Allegory of Plato's Cave? A lot of people. Great. Great. Wonderful. I'm just going to quickly summarize then. Plato likened the human experience to having been a prisoner inside a cave since early childhood. According to Plato, you and I have been sitting fixed to the same spot in a cave, unable to turn our heads or move our arms and legs because of fetters, making it possible for us to only see the cave wall directly in front of ourselves. Whoops, I was supposed to advance that. There we go. So this is a crude depiction of this allegory. Okay, so you can only see the cave wall in front of yourselves. Light inside the cave is provided by a large fire burning some distance behind us. Okay, less far behind, but on higher ground, is a wall with a path running behind it. On this path, other people walk, some speaking, some silent, while carrying a variety of artifacts over their heads. Statues of humans, animals, and other objects made of stone, wool, or stone, wood, or clay. So the path's wall acts as a sort of screen, similar to that employed by puppeteers as they hide while raising their puppets into view. We prisoners, looking only straight ahead at the cave wall, never actually see the people who are carrying the objects or even their human shadows. We see only moving shadows of the objects they carry and hear occasional voices bouncing off the cave wall in front of us. As a result, we begin to attribute forms to these shadows, and we assume that the shadows represent the entirety of the forms. Okay? So Plato explains, the prisoners in every way, and so this is us, right? We are the prisoners. In every way believe that the truth is nothing other than the shadows of those artifacts. So this allegory depicts the problem of objectification very well indeed. Without realizing it, we are in many ways handicapped, immobilized in our lives, because we are too often unable, or worse, unwilling to appreciate the deeper truths of reality. Plato believed that it was the philosopher's job to help enlighten humanity to this very predicament that we're all in. Okay? Much more recently, The eminent American philosopher Jacob Needleman asserted that when all the world's great philosophies and religious traditions are sifted for commonalities, three central ideas emerge. And notice how closely Plato's assertions are validated. First, human beings live in a world of appearances and illusions. Second, human beings' ordinary sense of identity is not their true fundamental identity. And third, an overarching structure exists which gives order to the cosmos and connects all things together into one great whole. Right? Almost sounds like a Disney slogan. So why has it required great sages to reveal this wisdom? Why aren't we human beings more generally aware of these realities? I suggest the answer to these questions goes right to the heart of what it means to be human. Time will only permit me to focus on a few important elements as they relate to objectification. Okay, so what keeps us in this cave? When we are infants, we don't realize that there is any physical separation between our caregivers and ourselves. However, by the time we are toddlers, like this young man, we have acquired a budding sense of the self as separate, which gains momentum every day. This comes from a variety of sources. We've been given a unique name and are treated as precious and special. We also begin to develop the capacity for naming things, and the words I, me, and mine come quickly to most children, as any of you parents know very well. Soon, one's thoughts and feelings about one's body, gender identity, friends, family, and possessions are added to the self-concept. Continued development sees more complicated perceptions and emotions about nationality, race, and religion being added. Opinions, preferences, roles, and an accumulated selective memory of events thought of as the story of my life help to further round out our sense of self. This process of socialization results in what is called the ego. This is the superficial sense of self Needleman referred to earlier. It is also the sense of self that most of us are most familiar with. The ego gives us all the impression that we are not only separate and distinct from everything else on a physical level, but on a spiritual level also. And it is this sense of separation which makes the objectification of others possible. If there's one takeaway that you leave with today from my presentation, I want it to be this. It is this sense of separation which makes objectification possible. Okay? All right, so how does the ego operate? Cultures all around the world have recognized the characteristics of the ego, and while each culture may call it by a different name, the human ego acts the same way regardless of time and place. First, the ego is enhanced through its identification with objects. And some of my favorite objects are these up here on the upper left. Right? I love my Vespa and I love my Rickenbacker guitar. Right? I love that stuff. The advertising industry has long been well aware of this fact and seeks to make us feel inadequate or insecure unless we possess certain products. Second, the ego attaches to things. It encourages excessive preoccupation or deep emotional investment with things like cars or beach houses or attitudes and emotions like grudges. Third, the ego wants things. This means that the satisfaction we gain from getting something new lasts only a brief amount of time. Haven't you noticed? Right? Before long, we find ourselves wanting something else. Fourth, the ego thrives on feelings of separateness and difference. It's hard to reinforce the notion of me without also clarifying what isn't me, creating labels and making boundaries and distinctions between oneself and others is one of the ego's favorite activities. Related to this is the ego's fascination and fusion with roles, where oneself becomes subsumed in the roles that we play, such as mother, father, doctor, lawyer, teacher, psychologist, and so forth. The authentic person underneath can literally become lost in the role. Related to this is the sixth attribute of ego, the need to be right and for others to be wrong. Resentment, complaining, name-calling strengthen the sense of boundary between ourselves and others, but also lend a sense of personal superiority over others. Seventh, the ego has a dysfunctional relationship with time. What this means is that the ego tends to center itself in thoughts of regretting the past or worrying about the future. What it doesn't emphasize is acceptance of the present moment of experience, which ironically is the only place that our lives are actually happening. Finally, the ego tends to equate having with being, like Walter White here in his pile of money, right? In other words, the ego measures life in terms of a person's accomplishments and possessions rather than on their deeper experiences of living. So that's the ego. One of the things that helped to keep us enclosed in Plato's cave. Okay? Second, narcissism. Closely related to the problem of ego, isn't that good? Yeah. Is the inborn human trait narcissism, which is the desire we all feel for self-preservation, self-promotion, and the perception of our own specialness and uniqueness. Narcissism is at its peak in childhood, where we see children being largely oblivious to how others, especially adults, might be feeling or what their preferences might be. The normal developmental course is for narcissism to diminish gradually as we age. Increasing social awareness, becoming parents, experiencing disappointments and setbacks, and the inevitable physical signs of aging, they all accumulate and put a damper on our sense of entitlement and specialness. However, in some cases, this is not so. Adults who display a high degree of grandiosity, fantasies of unlimited power, preoccupation with success, and a lack of empathy and a sense of entitlement are considered to have a psychological disorder. But even otherwise normal adults carry within them a substantial drive for self-perpetuation and self-promotion. Given this, it's easy to see why we are prone to objectifying others. Okay. Let's talk about death and how this is a problem. All right. So far as we can tell, human beings are the only creatures on earth consciously aware of their own mortality. In order to soothe the anxiety that this generates, we use our vast intelligence and our social tendencies to create culture in all of its various manifestations. Culture helps to answer a variety of cosmological questions, such as, who am I? Where did I come from? And where am I going? Does this sound familiar to anyone? Should. Yeah. It also provides us with roles to fulfill, the satisfaction of which allows us to feel like persons of value in a universe that has meaning. The great sociologist Peter Berger referred to these beneficial processes as the sacred canopy of culture. I love that. I think that's very well put. So what could possibly be wrong with all this, you're probably saying to yourself? Well, problems arise when cultural worldviews come into collision. The research shows that, oddly, if I am somehow reminded of my own death, say from repeated messages from certain politicians that the world is a consistently dangerous, unsafe place, or through incessant news images of terrorist attacks or mass shootings, then my existential anxiety is aroused, just like it was after 9/11, if you remember. Everybody's existential anxiety went up big time. Okay? As a result, I'm then much more likely to cling tightly to my own worldview and feel greater hostility toward those from different cultures. And the research shows this over and over and over. There are four main ways human beings deal with the existential discomfort. And as you'll see, they run the gamut from the relatively benign to the blatantly hostile. First, we might attempt to assimilate or accommodate the good parts of the alternative worldview into our own. And as we all remember from high school, Rome integrating the Greek gods into their own pantheon was a way of assimilating the good parts of another culture into your own, right? So we can assimilate or accommodate the worldview that threatens us. Or we can enter into a contest of ideas and attempt to convert others into our ways of thinking. For example, this is what missionaries are doing, right? Or we can derogate or put down the alternative worldview as being silly, ridiculous, primitive, backward, or even evil. And finally, and most extremely, we can just simply decide we're going to annihilate the alternative worldview. You can see how these last two have direct implications for our tendencies to objectify others. Because worldviews are human-generated, symbolic constructions rather than universally accepted realities, they require ongoing acceptance and validation by others in order to be fully imbued with death-denying qualities, right? And I think of fast and testimony meeting here somehow. Those who support our worldview are naturally going to be seen in a more positive light than those who do not support it. Such individuals are much more likely to be viewed as suspect, as a potential threat, and much more likely to be objectified, as the Native Americans were here. Okay, so let's shift focus just a little bit here and talk about situations and the role that they play. For most of human history, experts of the day assumed that the problem of human evil was properly located within human beings ourselves. In other words, a few bad apples exist in society, and all that's required is to properly identify and remove these individuals, and life will be much better for everyone else. However, shortly after World War II, social scientists, along with the rest of the world, were trying to answer the question, how could Auschwitz have happened? Right? Such questions led to a revolution in social psychological research, the likes of which the world will probably never see again. In short, we learned through the use of some very cleverly designed studies that a bad barrel can contaminate the apples within it. In other words, if otherwise normal, healthy people are put into toxic situations, their innate tendencies to objectify others can be dramatically enhanced. I have time to provide only the barest outlines of three relevant examples. Philip Zimbardo's famous Stanford prison experiment showed how adopting an arbitrary but powerful new role, complete with garb, right, a realistic setting, a ready means of aggression like a billy club and a whistle, and encouragement to use it, can move us along the objectification spectrum that I mentioned earlier. A study which was designed to last 2 weeks had to be called off after only 5 days because otherwise normal, healthy college students had lapsed into behavior which was in many ways highly reminiscent of the guards at Abu Ghraib prison 30 years later. Another Zimbardo study showed how de-individuation, and that's a fancy term for the loss of a person's sense of individuality and personal responsibility, like if you cover up your face with a mask or something, can play a role in antisocial behavior. Anytime we feel anonymous, that our reputations are not on the line, that no one knows or cares about who we are, seems to lay bare our tendencies to expand the innate sense of "I am not that" that we all experience. This makes it much easier to engage in immoral acts. Finally, Albert Bandura showed that the use of dehumanizing labels can move us along the objectification spectrum, altering both our perspective of others and our behaviors toward them. In one study, individuals had only to be labeled as animalistic and rotten. And if you think about, you know, the political rhetoric that's going on today, that's pretty mild stuff, animalistic and rotten, versus perceptive and understanding, right? That's all you had to do, was shift the label that much in order for subjects to be willing to shock people longer and more intensely. Pretty scary stuff. In summary, Philip Zimbardo coined this wonderful term, the Lucifer effect, when he spoke about how certain situational variables, such as toxic roles, de-individuation, and dehumanizing labels, can combine to transform human psychology and behavior from pro-social to antisocial, or from the perspective we're discussing here, from little or no objectification to strong objectification. All right. So let's talk about the solution, right? So what's to be done about all this? Recall, I said earlier that it was the sense of separateness which makes objectification possible, right? If this is true, then objectification's antidote would have to involve overcoming this sense of separateness. Perhaps it might not surprise us that the great sages of history have also had much to say about this. Indeed, as I argue in the book, this may be a novel way of understanding the world's great religions. Each is a particular mystical attempt to solve the problem of objectification by suggesting how to ultimately become one with life. Toward this end, each tradition specifies the problem, proposes a general solution to the problem, outlines a path to follow, and describes what successful implementation of that path looks like. And yet, how are we doing? The world's great faiths have been around for a long time. They have billions of adherents. And the problem of objectification is still very much with us. And indeed, many correctly argue that paradoxically, the world's great religions themselves have been at times a big part of the problem. At the same time, there's also no question that we have made progress. Not long ago, slavery was a valid means of conducting business and organizing a nation's economy. This would be unthinkable today. Not long ago, public executions such as hanging, beheading, breaking on the wheel, disemboweling, and drawing and quartering were common occurrences and were viewed as acceptable forms of not only punishment, but entertainment for the masses. This, too, would be unthinkable today, at least when it's not on film, right? Yeah. Okay. If you look at the last 2,000 years, the countries of Europe have been at almost perpetual war with one another. And this is Germany in 1555, okay? Look at how many different principalities and kingdoms there are there. Boundaries. Everywhere you draw a boundary, you have a battle line. Right? For every boundary, there's a battle line. And that's what Germany looked like in 1533. Okay? Doesn't look like that today. All right? It would now be unthinkable for, say, Germany to declare war on Britain, or for France to declare war on Belgium. Right? Indeed, as Harvard neurolinguist Steven Pinker points out in his excellent book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined, and I recommend that book to everyone. It's a wonderful read. Almost every form of violence that you can think of is much less prominent today than it was among our ancestors. However, this is not the narrative being promoted in church, where the world is regularly decried as being a worse and worse place to live, hastening a glorious apocalypse. The truth is that something positive is happening. Pinker lists a number of what he calls pacifying factors, historical and societal shifts exerting downward pressure on violence that go beyond the limits of this presentation. But both he and I argue that humanity is slowly but inexorably moving in the direction of greater enlightenment and less overall violence. As a sort of mirror opposite to the objectification spectrum that I presented earlier, I propose what I call the enlightenment spectrum, suggesting that enlightenment, the realization that we are one with life, is also best represented as a continuum running from low to high. When the objectification spectrum and the enlightenment spectrum are placed back to back, they form a grand spectrum of human capability, spanning from the very best of which we are capable to the very worst of which we are capable. But back to the enlightenment spectrum. And you can do a sort of self-check here to see where, you know, you may or may not fit in. At the low end of the enlightenment spectrum, we have casual concern. And this describes individuals who experience a low but meaningful level of ongoing self-boundary transcendence. These individuals possess a mild awareness of our basic kinship with the rest of humanity. While predominantly self-centered, the casually concerned are capable of brief periods of mindfulness, which means they experience moments of egolessness. So whenever you're truly mindful and you're in the moment, your ego goes on hold. Okay? That's what the sages have taught us. Casual concern has a set point of general goodwill toward the world at large, regardless of others' nationality, ethnicity, color, gender identity, sexual preference, political affiliation, or religious creed. The casually concerned also have a dim underlying sense of the problematic nature of nationalism and wars in general. Such individuals also have a basic concern for the environment and the experience of other conscious creatures. Yet this casual concern for all members of the species and the planet as a whole generally doesn't lead to consistent, meaningful action on behalf of others or the environment. So the second phase of the enlightenment spectrum, I called interconnectedness. Couldn't think of a better term, so I just used that. This represents the middle of the enlightenment spectrum, where realities only dimly perceived by the casually concerned come into clearer focus. For example, the interconnected are more often centered in the present moment of experience due to regular engagement in practices encouraging this state of being. While still possessing an ego, the interconnected are more aware of when they are in the ego's grip, and thereby they're capable of shortening the duration and the intensity of their egoic reactions. Because of their moderate level of self-boundary transcendence, the interconnected also recognize that truth knows no national, religious, or cultural boundaries. And that truth comes from a variety of sources and methods of inquiry. However, such individuals also recognize that not all cultural assumptions and values encourage human flourishing equally, nor do they map the realities of the physical universe equally well. The interconnected, ongoing sense of kinship with all human beings leads them to actively support policies making it possible for others to live under benevolent governments, the rule of law, and to have access to basic services that lay the foundation for human dignity. The interconnected also experience a heightened concern for other forms of life and the physical environment. Thus, they are aware of their ecological footprint. Such individuals are also more aware of the suffering of other sentient creatures and are therefore more likely to take steps to diminish collective planetary suffering of all kinds. Finally, such individuals are aware of the spiritually bankrupt nature of violence as a means of solving problems and so are likely to be committed to the ideals of nonviolence. Finally, at the high end of the Enlightenment spectrum, I use the American philosopher Ken Wilber's term here, unity consciousness. This represents the pinnacle of human awareness extolled by the world's great wisdom traditions. In this condition, we perceive that our identity does not stop at the boundary of our skin, but rather that we are one with other human beings, indeed, with all of existence. Much more could be said here, of course, as I try to do in the book, but time here is very short. Suffice to say that on a practical level, unity consciousness is not synonymous with psychosis. Okay? Such individuals recognize that they are persons with distinct location, needs, thoughts, feelings, and so forth. Nor are such persons perfected in a moral, psychological, intellectual, or a social sense. Yet, on a spiritual level, such people experience themselves as one with the rest of existence. Individuals experiencing unity consciousness live lives of full acceptance of the present moment as it is. As a result, they are able to engage in almost any activity mindfully, that is, without judgment or resistance. So to drastically oversimplify, those in unity consciousness experience two significant shifts in their consciousness. First is a decentration of self, where they take themselves out of the center of existence, because their circle of those who count as neighbor has expanded so dramatically. Does that make sense? And second is this Greek word kenosis, which means literally to pour out the self, where they give themselves over in radical love and trust to a source of identity that is much greater than the self. So given these remarkable attributes, we can see why such individuals seem to create zones of liberation. That's James Fowler's term that I really like. Zones of liberation around themselves, inspiring others to transcend the social, political, economic, and ideological limits of their time and place. Such individuals often put their lives on the line for complete strangers, and so they often run afoul of oppressive institutions. And as a result, they sometimes die at the hands of those they hope to help. Okay. All right. So unity consciousness seems a bit out of reach at the moment, at least for me. If solving the problem of objectification were easy, I think we would have figured it out by now. And if there was one single silver bullet that would do the trick, it would be heralded as the greatest discovery of human history. And yet we we have yet to find this easy solution. Despite this, there do seem to be some basic practical steps we can take each day to move a bit further up the Enlightenment spectrum and away from objectification. The following list of suggestions is in no way exhaustive, nor is it hierarchical, nor is it earth-shattering, okay? Nor will everyone have equal access to each of these strategies. However, such activities can contribute to helping us experience more of a sense of oneness with others. So let's just jump in here. So read, especially read great books by great authors. Why would this help? Does anyone have a thought about that? Why would this make any difference? Garrett.
Well, it's going to open you up to more worldviews that, say, read some Russian author, it opens you up to what they experience. And it sort of gives you a sense of how they live versus how you live.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Sam. Yes.
It then studies where fictional reading helps you empathize with other roles. You take on different character plots as you read a novel. That will help you to cope and to be more understanding of people around you.
Yeah, brilliant. Really fascinating research that shows, I think, what people have understood for a long time, personally. But the research now validates it. Yes?
Every time we read, we are experiencing leaving Plato's cave.
It's a nice way of putting it, especially if you're reading some good stuff, right? Because not all books and not all reading material is created equally, is it? No. So read, right? And spend time regularly in nature. And I'd love to pause and ask you why, you know, every single one of these could be helpful and move us more toward unity consciousness, but I'm afraid we won't have time, but for a time or two. So spend time in nature. How about this one? Plant a garden. How in the world could that help? But I think it does. I think it does. It helps you realize in some primal way that we all come from the same source. We're all nothing but dirt, guys. And the dirt is interstellar, right? I mean, it's really mind-blowing if you think about it. Travel. Pardon me? Someone said, okay. Travel and seek experiential adventures in lives and cultures different from your own. Educate yourself. Make education a lifelong process. In other words, never stop learning. Watch TED Talks. Watch a lot of them. Listen to podcasts when you're in the car, traveling. Make good use of that time. I'm not saying you can't listen to good music too, but just, you know, if you've got a long drive ahead of you, there's almost nothing better than having a really good book on tape to get you to, you know, 10 hours from point A to point B. Immerse yourself in the most inspiring, unifying, inclusive forms of your chosen faith tradition. And you know what those are, right? Things that stress compassion, service, inclusiveness, nonviolence. That's the good stuff that's common to not only Christianity in general, but to all the world's faiths in general, including Islam, by the way. Okay? Learn how to practice mindfulness and do it each day. Learn how to meditate and do it often. Learn how to practice yoga. These are huge. These are technologies that have been developed over many centuries. Technologies that were developed by a traumatized people for a traumatized people, right? And they just so happened to help slip certain individuals into enlightenment along the way, such as the Buddha, right? Yes?
What is it about yoga? I understand mindfulness and meditation. What is it about yoga?
Well, I would suggest that yoga is just another way of getting at the same thing. If you are practicing well, not only are you getting more limber, right? But you are grounding yourself in the present moment of experience of the body and you are leaving the realm of thought. If it's going well in yoga, it's just another way of getting there. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. Make a conscious effort to step into other people's shoes, even your enemies, Maybe I should say, especially your enemies, and find the humanity there. Like, I'm blanking on the senator's name who said that he loved Donald Trump, even though Trump had said some horrible things about him. I forget. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. Develop an interest in strangers or those different from you. Participate regularly in the visual and performing arts. All right, now why in the world could this help you become a slightly more enlightened person? Anybody? The visual and performing arts, how does that matter? How does that help?
Every piece of art is somebody's narrative, somebody's story that they're trying to tell. And so if you experience it, you are going into their world and learning more about them.
Leaving your own. Excellent. Very well put. Own a pet. Okay. We know a lot of pet people who may not seem so enlightened, I suppose, but owning a pet can make a difference, right? It can. We could talk about that, but we are running short on time. Here's a strange one, but I think it's true. Dance. How can dancing help make you a slightly more enlightened person? Can it? Most of the world's faith traditions, I guess even in Mormonism we encourage dance, don't we? We don't have our own dances per se, but yeah. Yeah, dance is a part of it. There's something about that that gets you out of your normal frame of reference and helps you physically connect with another human being and come to appreciate that, right? Serve others. That goes without saying, right? Getting outside of yourself there. Practice gratitude. That one's huge. This one can actually help with depression. It's something that I try to use myself each day, and I'm not very good at it, but I certainly encourage my clients to do it who are depressed, because there's a lot of research that shows this can make a small difference, right? Take emotional risks. Take emotional risks in relationships, right? That's what that picture is there. Become a parent. All right? Now, not everyone can become parents necessarily, but for those of us who have become parents, you know that it has an inalterable effect upon you. And hopefully you're a different person after you've had children than you were before. If you weren't, you probably shouldn't have had children. Right? Becoming a parent can help to play a small part in your becoming a more enlightened individual. All right? Vote. Take part in the civic process. Elections matter. I don't think I need to stress that too much right here and right now. Stay aware of current events. Know what's going on in the world around you. This will help you feel more compassion and more gratitude when you realize how good that you have it versus how bad somebody else has it right now. You can have compassion, you can have gratitude, and maybe you might even be able to do something to alleviate some suffering along the way. Right? Select a charity whose work impresses you and donate as you are able to on a regular basis. That is another thing that helps you become a slightly more enlightened person. And this one's massive. Practice acceptance of our lives each day. Right? Now, this is something of a paradox that I've had to learn the hard way in my life, and I talk to my clients about often. If you want to change your life, one of the best things you can do to start that process is to actually accept, radically accept your life as it is right now. That's the first step toward transformation. As weird as that sounds, as paradoxical as that sounds, that's a great truth. Yes?
What do you mean by radically accept?
Well, that's a fancy way of saying as substantially as you're able to say yes to whatever conditions you're experiencing right here, right now, be it tragic illness, misfortune of other kinds. No one wants these things. And I'm not encouraging anybody to be happy about any of these things, because that would be false. But if we can radically accept where we are at any given moment, we are then more in reality. And if we are more in reality, then we're going to be able to act more skillfully based on actual fact to take steps that can make an actual positive difference, right? So it's really about being in reality as much as you can be. Radical acceptance of the present will allow you to get where you want to be better than anything else, right? Okay. So, in the last minute or two, why does any of this matter? To quote Jimmy Carter very recently, in fact it was just the other night, he said, "We can and we must do better." Perhaps the greatest truth of existence is that there is no spiritual separateness between ourselves and anyone or anything else. That is the great revelation of the sages of all time, that at the deepest levels of perception that human beings are capable of, that's what you realize, regardless of what culture or what faith you come from. That's what you realize when you're perceiving most clearly. There is no spiritual separation. If we are going to do better, then we have to know ourselves better than we do now. Understanding our vulnerability toward objectifying others can encourage us to continue the long process of enlightenment. The very future of the world as we know it may actually depend upon this. Thank you very much.
Thank you for attending this session. We are out of time now, so if we want to continue discussions, we probably want to do that out in the hall. Okay, thank you very much.
Oh, by the way, Garrett, anyone who's interested, I didn't. Oxford said I was too late letting them know about the symposium to have any books here, but I do have flyers for a 30% discount on the book. My boy with the manila folder back there, if you're interested in a flyer, take a flyer, and if you'd get 30% off the book. So thank you.
Thank you.